So now I invite our brother Roger Varley to speak on the subject of after the death of Joshua.
Morning, brothers and sisters. Not too bad. Shall we try again? Morning, brothers and sisters. Morning. Thank you. At least I know there's somebody there. So we're short for time this morning, so we're going to have to whip through this fairly quickly, but hopefully we'll be able to learn some lessons together. So in Joshua, we hear, don't we? Moses, my servant, is dead. Therefore, Joshua, the Saviour, arise. And God says to Joshua, everywhere that your feet will tread, that is the land that I will give to you. So the Saviour goes ahead into the land, and that land where the feet of the Saviour trod was given to the children of Israel. You see, God had gone ahead of them, hadn't he, in time? And he saw a time when the people would dwell in the land. It was theirs for the taking. All they had to do was go in there and take it. And under the leadership of Joshua, they were able to do that. Because Joshua was the leader, he was their saviour, and they were united around him. And therefore, together as a unit, they were able to go into the land. And Judges chapters 1 and 2 gives us a progress of that, doesn't it? It tells us how that they took those areas, the tribes took their areas. But it's sad reading, isn't it, in one sense? It's sad because some of those areas that were taken were then taken back again. Jerusalem, for instance, was taken and then taken back at some point by the Jebusites. Some of the tribes lived alongside the inhabitants of the land. Some of the tribes put them to tribute. In other cases, the inhabitants of the land put the Israelites to tribute. And we have that really sad case right at the end of the regression. We have the tribe of Dan. And it tells us that Dan was more or less pushed up a mountain and not allowed to come down. And so it was a sad state, wasn't it? The progress wasn't being made. So what does Joshua do? As a good leader, what does a leader do? The leader gets the people together and he brings them to Shechem in Joshua chapter 24. Let's just turn there. So Joshua chapter 24, he brings all the people to Shechem and he tells them a story. He inspires them with the story of the nation. He tells them the journey that that nation has took. How that their forefathers worshipped gods on the other side of the river. And how that he called Abraham. And how Abraham responded. And how that they went down into Egypt. And eventually God brought them out of Egypt. And he covers how they conquered Og and Bashan, and they conquered Jericho, and they went through the trial at Baal Peor. And you see, Joshua was able to encourage the people by telling them what God had done in their lives. And he comes then to the ultimatum, doesn't he? In verse 14 of Joshua 24, now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom ye will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites, in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And there's a lot of psychology going on in this chapter, isn't there? He's trying to inspire them. And he puts himself there at the front as the example. You can make the choice yourself, but as for me and my household, we're going to serve the Lord. And then he tries the reverse psychology, doesn't he? When the people say, yes, we will do that, in verse 19 then, He then goes, and Joshua said unto the people, you cannot serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions nor your sins. And therefore Joshua, provoking the people, saying, you say this, but you're not going to do it. And the people said, yes, we are going to do it, Joshua. So Joshua gets a stone. And Joshua says, okay, this stone is the witness between you and God that you are going to do what he says. And when you get into the land, you are going to obey him. And Joshua gets the stone. And where does he place it? He places it under the oak at Shechem. Highly likely, brothers and sisters, that that was the same oak. If you remember, when God told Jacob to go to Bethel, he told his family, I want you to put away your idols, because now we are going to serve the God in whom I trust, the God that I know. And I want you to bury your idols. And they buried their idols under the oak tree at Shechem. And now Joshua, highly likely to be the same oak tree, is saying, put your idols away, just as your forefather Jacob did. And so all the people agree to this. And it tells us in verse 31 of that chapter, and Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, and which had known all the works of the Lord that he had done. So during the time of Joshua and those people that outlived Joshua, the people abode by that covenant that they had made with Joshua and with God. And yet it's a sad state, isn't it? Because when we go over to Judges chapter 2, we read the following. Verse 7, and the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord that he did in Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres. Verse 10. And also all the generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. How could that generation not have known what the Lord had done for them? And I want to suggest that people had stopped telling the stories. They had stopped telling the people what had been done for them by the Lord. And it meant nothing to them. They had the law, they had the rituals, but it meant absolutely nothing because they didn't have the meaning. And I wonder about our community, brothers and sisters. What legacy are we leaving for our next generation? They know all the stories. They go to their Sunday school. They could tell you all the stories about God and about the Bible. But what does it mean to them? Have you told them your story? Have you told them the story of how you came into contact with God? How you were converted? The troubles that you have been through? Maybe how you met your partner? Maybe why you decided to do the job that you did? Maybe the reason why you decided to do the things that you did in your life, the problems that you faced, and who was the person that you turned to? You turned to God. And God answered your prayers, and God delivered you, and God showed you the way. And do we tell our children those stories? Because without that, it'll mean nothing to them. When they're old enough to know us, they see us, don't they, as a stable brother or sister in the meeting, and we've got a lovely structure around us and a community around us, but that doesn't tell them the story. It doesn't tell them the story how we rely on God to work in our lives and how he has brought us on that journey. And that's what we need to start telling our children, so that they too will know how God has worked in our lives and how he will then work in their lives when they face those problems. So let's just turn to Judges just for a moment. Just as a bit of an introduction, really. It's quite interesting when you look at the framework of Judges, how that there's this sort of regression all the way through Judges. Things get worse and worse and worse and worse, and that's how it's portrayed to us. And incidentally, in chapter one here of Judges, we start off with the tribe of Judah, and we end with the tribe of Dan. That's interesting. In the Judges, we start with a judge from Judah, Othniel. We end with a judge from Dan. And it's Dan that we're going to have a look at to start our studies this morning. We're going to go to chapters 17 and chapters 18, which looks as though we're starting at the end of Judges, but actually chronologically, these chapters come at the beginning. And they're almost appendices to the book, really, to show how bad things really were. Why do we know that these chapters appear at the beginning of Judges rather at the first? Well, there is a mention of Shiloh. There's a mention of Phinehas in these chapters. And Phinehas, as we know, came at the beginning with Joshua. There's a mention that of a place called Menem Dan, which was a place that when Samson came along, that place was already in existence. So it must have come before Samson. But we're going to have a look at these chapters 17 and 18. Now, who wrote Judges? I want to suggest to you that the person that wrote Judges was Samuel. And most commentators probably agree with that. Why do we think Samuel? Well, in the book of Judges, we get mention of Shiloh being taken away. We get the mention of the ark being taken into captivity with the Philistines. And we get mention of the city of Jerusalem. All those things weren't in existence earlier. So really, this is probably Samuel now looking back from a time under David, looking back at the time of the Judges, and just looking how bad it was during that time. You see, under the Judges, the tribes were fragmented. There was no structure. There was no leader. And hence why people did what was right in their own eyes, because there was nobody to tell them any different. And there's a really fine line, isn't there, between doing what is right and acceptable before God and doing what we think is right but is actually unacceptable to God. And therefore, Samuel, now looking at a time when the temple was established in Jerusalem and there was a king on the throne who reigned in as close to righteousness and justice as you could get under David, he was now looking back at this time, this fragmented time, and saying, no wonder the people did what was right in their own eyes, because there was just no structure to their order of worship. If you look through the book of Judges, there is no mention of the priests. There's no mention of the Levites, apart from these chapters that we're going to read. But they came right at the beginning. Now, this was supposed to be a society that was driven by God through the priesthood. And yet there was no mention of the work of the priest. There was no mention of what happened at Shiloh, apart from what we read towards the end. Where was the leadership in these days? Let's just go to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Verse 2, just to set the scene. Deuteronomy Deuteronomy 7, verse 2, and when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. Verse 5, but thus shall ye deal with them. Ye shall destroy altars and break down their images and cut down their groves and burn their graven images with fire. That was the instruction. But what do you do when you're isolated in the land and you're looking for something to worship? Well, hold on a minute. There's all these nations round about. They worship gods. I'm a farmer now. Who do I worship? Well, the people of the land worship the gods of the harvest and the gods of nature. I'll start to worship those so that I get my crops blessed. And you can see how it happens, can't you? This compromise of people trying to fit in with the local people, they do what the locals do. They go along to their festivals and celebrate their feasts. And that's exactly what was happening, because there was a compromise situation where people wanted to worship something, but they didn't actually know what it was and how to do it. And therefore they got dragged in to the worship of the nations round about. Just go on to Deuteronomy 12, which was the reading that we had. In Deuteronomy 12 here, God talks of the place, doesn't he? Verse 5, but unto the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all your tribes to put his name there, even unto his habitation shall ye seek, and thither thou shalt come. And God talks of a time when there will be a place in the land where everyone will go and everyone will worship God, and it will unite the people. And during the times of Judges, they had Shiloh. But we know what a corrupt place Shiloh was, don't we? And therefore there was nowhere for people to go. Verse 8, ye shall not do after all the things that we do here. This day every man whatsoever is right in his own eyes. And that is the catchphrase, isn't it, for Judges? Everyone doing what is right in their own eyes. And Moses is suggesting here, isn't he, that actually they were already worshipping false gods. I think it's in Stephen's speech where he talks about the fact that they were carrying around the tabernacle of Molech and Rephem in the wilderness with them. They were already worshipping those false gods. And Moses is saying, you're not going to do that when we go in the land. You're not going to do what is right in your own eyes. Verse 13, take heed to thyself that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest. And as we go through Judges, that happens everywhere. Burnt offerings being made under every tree and high place. And finally, just one verse I want to catch up on. Verse 19. Take heed to thyself that thou forsake not the Levite as long as thou livest upon the earth. And you'll see why that is relevant in a few moments. The priests, the Levites, were vulnerable, weren't they? Because they depended on the people. No lands, although they were given lands around their towns. But a lot of those towns hadn't been taken. They were still in the possession of the enemies. And with no worship happening around the land, what were the Levites supposed to do? How were they supposed to earn their income? How are they supposed to get their food and the supplies that they need? And therefore God says, take heed that you do not forsake the Levites which are in your land. Okay, let's go to Judges chapter 17 here, and let's have a look at this situation. See how I'm doing for time. We're running out of time. So we have a situation here with this man called Micah. Interestingly enough, Micah means he who is like God. And this man was somebody who wanted to be God, but he was nothing like God. He wanted to be like God because he wanted a say in how he worshipped, how he set things up, who was going to worship on his behalf. And there's an irony there, isn't there, that his name should have been I want to be like God. And yet he was nothing like God. And everything's wrong about this family here. We have this man, Micah. He's got some sons, we know that. His sons are grown up because he later appoints them as priests. So they're grown up family. And he's got a mother. So we've got a man with a grown up family and he steals off his mother. He steals 1,100 shekels of silver, talents of silver, from his mother. Who would do such a thing? And what's more, the mother, she curses him. Now, I don't know how she could curse him. She obviously thought that she could curse by some god. And the man then repents and says, okay, have your money back, mother. And then the mother says, oh, well, now I'm going to bless you by God. And this whole house was full of superstitious practices, wasn't it? Because then she said, with that money, that 1,100, let me just get it right, is it talent, shekels of silver, I'm going to devote those to God. Brilliant. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to give it to you in order that you can make idols. Everything was mixed up. People thinking that they could serve God in their own way by doing things that they thought was right in their own eyes. Verse 5. And the man Micah had a house of gods and made an ephod and a teraphim and consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. Who gave him authority to do that? He was doing what was right in his own eyes. He sets up a house of worship. It sounds like it's a very well-to-do house. No doubt, it was probably the house in the village where everybody used to go to. Micah's got his new gods in this week. Let's go along and have a look. Let's go and worship with Micah. And therefore, this house became well known. It was on the main northern route that headed up north. And therefore, any travellers going up north would probably pass by Micah's house, maybe a few shrines by the side of the road. And therefore, we can hardly blame it. This man then, verse 7, there was a young man out of Bethlehem, Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he sojourned there. And the man departed out of the city from Bethlehem, Judah, to sojourn where he could find a place. And he came to Mount Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed. So what was this Levite doing, roaming around the country? The phrase there where it says he could find a place, apparently in the Hebrew it means he was looking for a job. Because there was no jobs for the Levites in Israel. Because everyone had forsaken God. And so this man now, wanting to find somewhere he could stay, practice his trade, and live. And therefore he's heard of this man, Micah, and he goes to see him. Now, who is this man? Well, we find out who this man is in chapter 18. And his name is Jonathan, verse 30 of chapter 18. So, and the children of Dan set up a graven image. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, he and his sons were priests. So this young man, this Levite, was a man called Jonathan. And commentators and experts of the text will say that there is a corruption here of the text. Because this man, Jonathan, was not the grandson of Manasseh. He was the grandson of Moses. And people have suggested that the Hebrew scholars were so embarrassed by the fact that this was a grandson of their great leader, Moses, that they put an extra, I think it's a nun, in there to make it Manasseh. Sorry, yeah, Manasseh rather than Moses. And so we have this man, well known, famous, the grandson of Moses, looking for work. And that shouldn't have been the case should it? Let's just consider him just for a few moments. So what does Micah do with this man? Verse 10. And Micah said unto him, dwell with me, and be unto me a father and a priest, and I will give thee 10 shekels of silver by the year, and a suit of apparel, and thy victuals. So the Levite went in, and the Levite was content to dwell with the man, and the young man was unto him as one of the sons, one of his sons. And Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and was in the house of Micah. Then said Micah, now know I that God will do me good, seeing I have a Levite to my priest. And so this situation was just one of compromise, wasn't it? It was a man who, I guess, wanted to worship God, but didn't know how. So he thought, okay, I will make my own shrine. I will make my own gods. I will get my own priest in. And therefore, I can have a cheap, easy, convenient religion, where really I just turn up, I worship, but really the priest can do everything for me. And because of that, God will bless me. And that's the lesson of our lives as well, isn't it, sometimes? Is that we think if we can put certain things in place, maybe do a deal with God, say, if I do this, then will you bless me? Will you do this, 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 and this? And there is a real danger, isn't there, in our worship, that we can do those sorts of things. We can try and make a deal with God, that if we do this, then God will do this. And that's not how worshiping God works, is it? God blesses us regardless. But that's the situation in Micah. Now, let's move on then to the Danites. Because along then come the Danites. What do we know about the Danites? Well, let's go to Genesis 30 to start off with. And I think this gives us a really good insight into the tribe of Dan. Genesis 30, and we have here Jacob's blessings to his son. Oh, sorry, no, we don't. We have Rachel. Rachel, the mother, Rachel couldn't have children, could she? So what she does is she takes matters into her own hands. So, in effect, what she's doing is she is doing what she thinks is right in her own eyes. And what she does is she gives her handmaid, Bilhah, to Jacob, so that she can have a child via her handmaid. So doing what she thinks is right, but what actually isn't right. And in verse 4, and she gave him Bilhah, her handmaid, to wife, and Jacob went in unto her, and Bilhah conceived and bare Jacob a son. And Rachel said, God hath judged me, and hath also heard my voice, and hath given me a son. Therefore called she his name Dan. So Dan was born under the pretense that Rachel had done the right thing, and that God had actually blessed her for doing what she thought was right in her own eyes. And Dan was exactly the same. As we all go on to see, is that Dan does things which he thinks are right, but they're right in his own eyes. Genesis 49. Here we have Jacob's blessings. Verse 16 of Genesis 49. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path that biteth the horse heels, so that his rider shall fall backward. So Dan here is referred to as this serpent, this adder. And we know the symbol of the serpent, don't we, in the Bible? The serpent was the one that deceived from the very beginning, that led people astray, that made people do things that they seemed were right, but actually they weren't. And we'll come back to these verses later on tomorrow, because there's another fulfillment of them as well. But Dan then, the serpent, Deuteronomy chapter 33, and we have now Moses' blessings. Deuteronomy 33, verse 22. And of Dan he said, Dan is a lion's whelp. He shall leap from Bashan. Now, I don't really know what that means. Why is Dan a lion's whelp? Well, I have an idea, which I'll come back to in a few minutes. Why is Dan a lion's whelp? Okay. The Danites were the second largest tribe, and they were given the smallest inheritance. Now, how would you feel about that? How do we feel, maybe, when we feel that we deserve something better in life? Maybe a bigger car, maybe a bigger house. Sometimes we feel a bit outdone, don't we? And that was the case for Dan here, is that he was not happy with his inheritance. Some of it was his own fault, as we read in Judges 2. He wasn't able to take the land. And therefore he was constrained to that mountain, probably between those two cities. He wasn't helped either, was he, really, by his neighbours. He was a bit neglected, because Dan was placed between Judah in the south and Ephraim in the north. Two big tribes, two major players. Did he get any help from them? Well, not really. Ephraim was able to take his portion in the north of his inheritance, but left the south unguarded. And so that had an impact on Dan's territory. And there's a lesson there, isn't there, that sometimes the most vulnerable people in our ecclesia, the people that need our help the most, God places them right at the heart of the ecclesia, surrounded by maybe some of our stronger brethren and sisters. But you see, what happens is if they don't get the help that they need, they start feeling discontent. Maybe they start feel that they don't have a place in the ecclesia. And before long, we don't see them again. They've gone because they're unhappy. They've gone to find something better. And when we go to Judges chapter 17, that's what we 18, that's what we find happens with this tribe of Dan. Let's just go back to Judges 18. Verse 1. In the days there was no king in Israel, and in those days the tribe of the Danites sought them an inheritance to dwell in. For unto that day all their inheritance had not fallen unto them among the tribes of Israel. And the children of Dan sent to their family 5 men from their coasts, men of valour from Zorah and from Eshtael, to spy out the land and to search it. And they said unto them, go search the land, who when they came to Mount Ephraim, to the house of Micah, they lodged there. So this was a search from a tribe looking for somewhere to go. They were isolated. Maybe they were on the fringe of the ecclesia for some time, but eventually they just dropped off. We're going to go somewhere else. And therefore, in their search for a new place, they happened to come across the house of Micah, who had a form of worship that actually appealed to them. Because Micah had a Levite. He had some gods. He had a shrine. And this appealed to Dan. And they'd taken note of this, hadn't they? These 5 men that had went through. So that later, when the whole tribe came through and they were a bit braver because they had 600 men with them, they were able to go and take the Levite and take the idols from Micah's house. and go and take them up north in order to set up their shrine in the north, in their inheritance. I've only got one slide for this session. So here we have Dan's inheritance here. It looks a fairly sizable chunk, really, but they weren't able to take it. So what they did is they travelled up here, through here where Micah's house was. We're not too sure where his house was. Up the Jordan River, along here. Now, Naish is right up here, so somehow they made their way up here. Now, when it says there in Moses' blessing that Dan was a lion's whelp leaping from Bashan, I think what probably happened is that they came round here and they attacked this unsuspecting village from this side of the Jordan, maybe from Bashan, and then in that way they left. Now it's interesting, the word Laish is a poetic term for lion. Its root is lion. So when it says Dan was a lion's whelp, Dan became a product of Laish, the lion, and everything that Laish embodied, Dan became a product of that. So let's just have a quick look. What was Laish? Well, verse 7. Then the five men departed and came to Laish and saw the people that were therein, how they dwelt careless, after the manner of the Zidonians. Who was a Zidonian? Jezebel was a Zidonian. Quiet and secure, and there was no magistrate. That means no air of restraint. You see, this was a place where people just did what they wanted to. They were careless. They just dwelt in safety. Nobody's going to bother us. If I want to do this, I can do it. If I want to do that, I can do it. And you can see how this would appeal to the tribe of Dan. Maybe feeling a bit aggrieved by the fact that they've had to leave their inheritance and nobody has helped them. And there they go and find the easy option. Rather than defeating the giants that were in their land, they're now going to defeat this unsuspecting people who are peaceable. And that's the easy way out, isn't it? And therefore, where does Dan end up? Well, Dan ends up on the edge, doesn't he? He ends up on the edge of the kingdom. He ends up actually with a foot in each camp, because there were still some Danites still in their inheritance down there. But he also had a foot up there. And sometimes that suits us, doesn't it? To have one foot in the ecclesia and one foot out of the ecclesia. Because when we want to do the things that we want to do that are not a part of God's plan, then we can go outside of the ecclesia to do them. When we want our religion, we can do those inside the ecclesia. So what legacy was left by Dan? Well, verse 29, we've read this. Verse 29, and they called the name of the city Dan. And that takes us back, doesn't it, to when Cain had his own city. Then when Nimrod had his own kingdom, named it after themselves. And now Dan here is naming the city after their forefather Dan. And the legacy of Dan is this. Now when David came along, I'm sure David got rid of all the idols in Dan. But you see, the custom was still there, wasn't it? And so when Jeroboam comes along, and Jeroboam says, I know, we will put some calves in our cities to worship. Where should we put one? I know, let's put one in Dan, because they like that sort of thing. And there was no objection from Dan. The other one, of course, went into Bethel, the house of God. And in Bethel, they had to appoint priests in order to serve that golden calf. They didn't have to do that in Dan, because they already had people and priests in Dan who were already willing to serve that calf. And it's a sad state, isn't it, that Dan is missing from some of the records. In the genealogies, in Chronicles, Dan's name doesn't appear. It's almost as if they've been written out of the book of life. In Revelation 7, when it talks about those people that are sealed from the tribes, Dan is missing. He's been written off because of the apostasy. So what can we learn then? Well, we can learn a lot, can't we, from Micah and from Dan. We can learn that sometimes doing what we think is right, how we think we might want to serve God, is actually wrong. We can learn lessons from Dan, who dwelt on the fringes, who didn't really have much engagement, but ultimately decided to leave because they liked it better somewhere else. Maybe we can learn that really we should be content with the lot that has been given to us and work hard to make that our inheritance, because that's why God's given it us. And maybe we should learn not to decide on a course without praying to God about it first, because that's what Rachel did and that's what Dan did. They took matters into their own hands and it led to trouble. Thank you.